Welcome back to the Thermodiet Podcast. I'm your host, Jayton Miller, and today I have on the podcast Libby Westcomb. So today we talk about just about everything there is to talk about whenever it comes to performance, building muscle, and just being an awesome human being. Libby is very knowledgeable in pretty much all of the realm of being metabolically friendly and building muscle and being an athlete. So I'm super excited for y'all to be able to listen to this one. Let's dive in. Libby, how's it going today?
Hello. It's great. How are you?
I'm doing well. So do you mind kind of going over who you are and what you do and kind of your background for the listeners who might not know who you are?
Sure. So I was a CrossFit coach and a personal trainer for many years. Did my nutrition studies as well during that time. That was probably an 8 to 10 year stint. I was also kind of a more competitive CrossFitter as well. I was at a few regionals, which is kind of like all of Australia before you get to the World Games. So I kind of got to that level. So I definitely had that competitive side to me as well. I started doing my own business with women from when I was a CrossFit coach, mainly just helping them with their nutrition, particularly because I saw in the CrossFit world, there was a lot of just lack of knowledge of how to eat and how much food you need for that type of training, which is very glycogen dependent, very high intensity training. So I kind of went into it when I was doing my studies. I decided to take a real, like, you know, niche down to the female athletes, the female, not just athlete, but a female who wants to train really hard and, you know, maybe isn't fueling correctly, is having issues. So that's kind of how I went into that realm, I guess. And then as far as, you know, more towards the end of my CrossFit coaching and training career, I started to stumble across the whole pro-metabolic way of eating. And the thing that I think drew me to that is that I saw a lot of women in the CrossFit space who I trained who had thyroid problems, health problems, metabolism issues. And it wasn't so much that they were purposely restricting or dieting, but it's just that they weren't supporting the output that they were doing every single day. So, you know, as we know, like, if you're not going to support the amount that you're expending, your body's going to take from somewhere else. So I was seeing like just a bit of a pattern and a common thread with a lot of these women. And that's where I started digging, because obviously I was coaching them. So I started digging into, you know, thyroid issues and the connection between temperature and your thyroid and all that kind of stuff. I actually found Weston A. Price work first. And from there I found Dr. Ray P. And, you know, then I started incorporating that into my coaching a little bit. What I was learning, I studied up on it as much as you can. I got his books and all that. And obviously it kind of just went from there. I met other people in this sort of in this industry who also have that same mentality about, you know, how to eat to support your metabolism and how, you know, all that. So that's kind of where I'm at now. I have an online business and I just work completely online, which is really cool that it's gotten to this point, especially considering all the lockdowns the last 2 years. So it's been really good in that way. And I still work a lot with active women, ex-CrossFitters, current CrossFitters. I also take on other, you know, just all types now. That's me in a nutshell.
That's awesome. So what kind of training do you usually, what does your training look like now?
So now I'm kind of more doing a bit of bodybuilding. I like to do different types of training. Like, I'm not like a snob when it comes to training and I have to, you know, just do one thing, because I guess probably because my CrossFit background, they're really big on, you know, being well-rounded, as a well-rounded athlete as you can. So I do like stints of different things. I guess you could call it like when you do you know, your periodization, you might do like 4 months or 6 months of just like bodybuilding, and then I might go and have a break from that, which I probably will in a couple months, and do more of a functional style training again. It almost resensitizes you to bodybuilding again when you want to go back to it, because obviously, especially as women, we have a kind of a limit when it comes to building muscle. We don't have as much testosterone as guys, so it does, you know, I feel like if you're just going to do bodybuilding all year, you'll get to that point pretty fast where it's hard to progress sometimes. So I do actually include a little bit of conditioning. I come from as well a athletic background, like track and field, so more just the 50 to 100 meter sprints. So I still love that. And I find that really supports weight training and bodybuilding as well, because it's very quick. You know, it's using those fast muscle twitch fiber. And, you know, you're going to use mostly those when you're doing like heavy weight lifting and that. So it kind of does complement it. So I do that more year round, a couple times a week as well. I just try to be as sort of well-rounded and balanced as possible now, because I'm not really an athlete anymore. I don't have any competitive endeavors that I'm going for. I'm pretty big on just being well-rounded and then specializing in for parts of the year, if that makes sense, like that periodization style.
That's awesome. So what would you say would be like the most metabolically friendly approach to bodybuilding if you had to put together a strategy for that?
Yeah, it's with bodybuilding, it's interesting because it is kind of, it's like higher reps, you know, it's not that super CNS taxing work like you would do if you're doing powerlifting or something. So I would say probably the best approach would be not to overdo it. And I do like to focus more, I wouldn't say intensity, but I would say effort in training versus heaps and heaps of volume. So I like the, you know, whatever drives like, you know, metabolic tension is that higher intensity when it comes to lifting closer to your one rep max, doing that, doing it right, and not like doing junk volume every single day. Because I feel like at the end of the day, when it comes to like being metabolically healthy, you don't want to have continuous stressors on your body. And obviously, as we know, training is a stressor. So what I see a lot of people do is they think they're training well, but they're doing what I call junk volume, which is where you're not actually training close enough to failure, I guess you could say, muscular failure, that you're actually going to produce those adaptations that happen when you do train closer to muscular failure. And yet they're doing so much volume without actually hitting that sweet spot, as I call it. So they're getting all the fatigue and they're getting all the, you know, the stress from the training without the stimulus. So therefore you're just piling all this fatigue on your body for no result. And this is kind of my approach to training and health in general, is basically, you know, get the stressor. Like, it's not bad to stress your body, whether it's fat loss or whether it's training. It's like, do it, but do it right. Get it done properly and then get, you know, move on to the next thing. So, you know, I think it's this, I often call it like metabolic wasteland. I used to call it that in the CrossFit world, where it's just you're in this place where you're putting all the stress on your body for no result. It's like you're spinning your wheels. So I think with bodybuilding, the most metabolically healthy thing to do would really be to nail the process of, you know, how are we driving that mechanical tension on our muscles, which is what drives results. It's the biggest thing that drives results. And the best way to do that is to lift, you know, heavy enough weight for you. Obviously, everyone's different, so it needs to be close enough to your one rep max, but not at failure. I wouldn't lift to failure every day, because that's also stressful on the body. And you can get the same results close enough to failure without going all the way to failure. And then making sure that, you know, your execution is on point. This is huge as well for me. It's just, you know, generating enough muscular tension when you do the lifts, making sure that you are, you know, I would say focusing on every rep, making sure your execution is perfect. I like to say standardize your reps as much as possible. You know, I see a lot of people not realize, but they might do a set and their first rep looks completely different to the last rep. So you're still, as I said, getting all that stress on your body because you're still doing all those squats, for example, but they're not really working as far as building muscle because you're not getting that mechanical tension enough on the muscles. So yeah, I think that it's just being really aware of your performance, aware of your execution, and as well as that, just making sure that you are working hard enough and pushing hard enough. Kind of like make the stress worth it. Mm-hmm.
Are there certain like weight percentages that you found typically work best for that?
Yeah, I personally don't use one rep maxes, or like I don't get my clients to work close to their percentages, but I use what's called reps in reserve or rate of perceived exertion, which is where, you know, you can work as, you know, if you have say 2 reps left in the tank or 3 reps left in the tank. I would say probably that sweet spot is like 80 to 85% of your one rep max generally. That's where I like to hang for most of my training. So the issue with going beyond that, which some people do, like I might not be right in everything I'm saying, because there are definitely some people that I respect in the industry who do say, you know, just push to failure. But the issue I have with that is that the studies actually show that you get just as much, you know, mechanical tension from working within like 2 reps to failure, 3 reps to failure, as you do working completely to failure, but you get less stress on the body. So, you know, the stimulus to fatigue ratio, if you're going completely to failure where you're working so you can't do another rep, that fatigue goes way up, but the stimulus stays very similar to if you just work to the last sort of 2 to 3 reps in reserve. I would say 2 reps in the tank is a good sweet spot for most people. So that's kind of where I would hang out for most of my like training, particularly those bigger compound lifts that, you know, can be really taxing, like squats or deadlifts or, you know, shoulder press, bench press, those types of things. So that's kind of more my guide. And I would say it probably is around 80 to 85% as an average.
Okay. So whenever it comes to taxing the body in this way, from, you know, whether it's like metabolic or in lactic acid style of training, are those short-term stressors that we're going through, are they worth the benefits that we receive in the long run?
I think it's sometimes it is. So this is where I come back to that point about junk training. And so as a previous CrossFitter and CrossFit coach and competitor, I know all about that lactic threshold and the lactic acid and that, because that's literally that type of training. So if you were someone who was competitive, for example, you would in CrossFit, you would have to be doing that a lot. But where a lot of women miss the mark these days is they choose to do that type of high intensity training, you know, those, they call them HIIT classes, or, you know, even something like just lifting weights really, really fast, you know, circuit style training, all that kind of stuff. And what that's doing as well is that's putting that stress on, you know, it's going into that kind of energy system where you start to really burn through, you know, more lactic acid. And that's very stressful on the body. And if you don't have a purpose or reason for doing that, like, so a lot of women would say, you know, I want to build muscle, or I want to lose fat, or I want to have this particular body composition. And they think that's the way they need to train to do it. But again, what they're doing is they're just stressing their body out by doing all that sort of really high intensity. I wouldn't say it's more anaerobic, but I wouldn't say it's like completely anaerobic. Sometimes it's on the cusp of, like, you know, how the aerobic energy system has different zones. It would be pushing towards that end zone aerobic, which I find is like the most dangerous place where a lot of women sit. Because they're, you know, they're not going into that completely anaerobic place where you start to burn glycogen more. So, you know, you're using carbs up, but it's that in between place, which is, you know, they're not actually working hard enough to use glycogen that much. So, but then they're not staying, you know, in that low intensity aerobic, which is a lot more parasympathetic. So it's that place there where you'll see, you know, spin classes, F45, I think they call it Orange Theory. They have Orange Theory there in America. You know, CrossFit and Metcon, so metabolic conditioning, that sort of place, that's where I feel like the stress almost outweighs the benefits in terms of, like, what are you doing it for? Unless you're a competitive athlete or a CrossFitter like I was, we literally had to be fit in that way because that was what it was all about. So yeah, I think it's just looking at what your goals are for training. And then how can you reach those goals in the healthiest way, in the quickest way, with as little stress as possible. And some people take this to the other extreme where they're like, oh, I'm so scared of stress, you know. And I'm often also saying, you know, don't be scared of stress. Let the stressor do its thing. You have to become inflammatory after you train. That's part of it. You have to be in that sympathetic state. That's all part of it. You're not going to get the results you want. You're not going to build that body you want unless you do that. But, you know, do it properly, like make it worth it, use it as you need to, and then come out of it, go back into that parasympathetic state, you know, make sure you do a cool down, recover, and all of that. So I think it's literally just using the stress for the right purpose, not just, you know, continuously stressing yourself on a cycle where you're not getting the benefits and the results from it, but you're getting all that excess stress, that chronic stress going on in your body. Does that make sense?
Yes. So would you leave it up to intensity in that case then?
Yeah. So to me, there's intensity and volume. And those things aren't actually what I put on the bottom of like my personal hierarchy when it comes to training, because intensity basically means in terms of weightlifting and that is working very close to your, you know, one rep max. So keeping the weights really close to there. But what I like to put below that as a priority is, as I said, that effort and execution. So literally, if you can nail those two things. So what I mean by effort is whether you're doing 20 reps, you know, that's not close to your one rep max of a certain weight. If you can go to that point where you have, you know, just 2 reps left in the tank, just 3 reps left in the tank, and your execution is completely on point, all your reps look the same, you know, all of that's nailed, like you've nailed that and you've nailed the effort. That's kind of where I'm seeing the best results for women. It's like, okay, those are those sets that are really going to carry over into getting you the gains that you want. Because that mechanical tension is there. And to me, that's everything. The mechanical tension is what drives, like we do have obviously metabolic stress and muscular damage, but those things are so much less of importance than mechanical tension. And the best way to drive that mechanical tension is to, as I said, make sure that you're doing those reps close enough to failure and that your execution stays on point. So if you do that with, like, you know, 3 times a week, you're going to get really great results, and you're probably going to get better results than smashing yourself 6 times a week without ever hitting those sets, those good quality sets. Mm-hmm. That's kind of where I sit on the volume versus intensity.
Mm-hmm. So are there any specific, like, recovery methods that you use whenever you're going through, like, really hard bouts of training?
Yeah. So personally, like, recovery is really my favorite topic. Personally, I think that people have to find kind of the symptoms that is personal to them that they're under recovering. And I found with my clients, everyone's a little bit different. Some people, you know, they'll start getting niggles or injuries. Some people will get sick more often. Their immune system will go down. Other people's temperatures will plummet, which I see often with women. So for me, I use heart rate variability because my temperatures are pretty steady. Like, they're quite, they just, you know, they don't move much, which is a good thing. But my heart rate variability really does plummet. So if I notice that that's gone down after a really hard session, I'm like, okay, take it easy today. So what I like to do is I like to do what I call intermittent intensity. So it's like I'll do a hard session where I'm doing, like, you know, let's say I'm doing 80 kilos front squats or something, and I'm going pretty close to my failure. Like, I'm 2 reps in the tank, you know, do 4 sets of that, for example, and then I'll do some accessory work after. Like, that's going to be pretty hard on the system. It's a heavy weight for me for those reps, and it's close to failure, right? So the next day, rather than going and backing it up with shoulder press close to failure and, you know, this, I might do like a recovery, what I call them, recovery sessions, where I'm just doing, you know, more lighter weights, constantly moving. And this is not the type of session that's going to actually get me the results, but this is the type of session that's going to help me recover then to go into the next session, which is going to be like another higher intensity type of session. I tend to use my heart rate, like, I wear a heart rate monitor, so I kind of know my zones as well. If I'm doing a recovery session, I'll just keep it within that zone 2, which is basically you're still able to breathe the whole time through your nose. You're able to keep a conversation with someone if they were working out with you. And it's literally just moving your muscles, but I often move them in the movement that I train. So I might be doing some squats. I might be doing, like, pushing a sled, that type of thing. So you're sort of getting the blood flow again. You're getting, you know, the aerobic system working, which is also, so the aerobic system also helps drive recovery because it helps your body go into that parasympathetic state. So I like to do those intermittently sometimes, especially if I'm in a really hard training phase where, say, I'm doing like 4 days a week of heavy weights, like bodybuilding, trying to get stronger, trying to build muscle. I'll sprinkle a couple of those sessions in between. And I find for me that just, like, skyrockets my recovery. If I do nothing and I just sit down all day, I tend to find my heart rate variability is still low and plummet the next day. Whereas if I do this type of movement, then it jumps back up. So I think everyone's different, and obviously my metabolism can handle that. Not everyone's can. So I would be saying, you know, if you need to look for a few different signs, you want to look for your temperatures the next day. If they're dropped, I would say it should be a pretty big drop, like not just a couple, you know, I'm in Celsius, so it's different for Fahrenheit, but if it would go down from like 36.8 to 36.3, it's a pretty big drop. And that just shows you that you are still in that sympathetic state, which is something that you don't want to just be living in, because the goal for training is to get into the sympathetic state while you're training and then to get out of it and go into that parasympathetic state, which I call the recovery state, which is where different things are happening in your body. Like you have more, you know, circulating amino acids, you have, you know, all sorts of like recovery anabolic type things happening. So that's why you'd want to get into that state quicker. So if your attempts are dropping, another thing that I see a lot of people struggle with is they'll do a session and obviously your heart rate's going to raise during the session, like if you're doing weights and bodybuilding and that, but then rather than the heart rate going back to baseline, it stays high. So that's just telling me that those stress hormones are still up and so they don't lower. So I'll get my clients sometimes to check their heart rate on the hour after they train, and oftentimes right up until like bedtime they're going to sleep, it's still pretty high. So I'm like, okay, either the training is not working for you right now, or we need to, you know, do more recovery type activities and that. So that's another thing. Obviously, if your sleep tanks, a lot of people's just, they'll do a really hard session and then they'll just sleep like shit the next night. And that's like a clear sign to me that, you know, they're just still recovering. So we need to help them with their recovery. Yeah, like, you know, mood swings, sickness, injuries, all these things are often signs that you're not recovering well. So I think it's really important to look at how your body tells you what signs and symptoms your body uses to tell you that you need to work on your recovery, because so many people just aren't aware. And if you become really, really aware of your body and what it's telling you, you can see it right away. Like, okay, well, that session's really, really hard and I'm not recovered yet, so I might need to do something else tomorrow rather than just like smashing it day after day.
Mm-hmm. Along with the recovery sessions, is there anything that you do, like Epsom salt baths or anything kind of like that you utilize?
Yeah, so I definitely do the Epsom salt bath, magnesium. I sometimes just do like a foot bath, magnesium foot bath, to get, you know, magnesium in. I'm not someone who's super big on like the, you know, like cold therapy and, you know, what's it called, float tanks and all that stuff. Like I've tried them all, but I just find personally for me, it's really just like food. So getting in those carbs and the protein right after, making sure I'm getting enough minerals in my diet is huge. I can tell if I'm not, then, you know, I can see different things, like, you know, even something as simple as getting cramps. If you start getting like cramps in your muscles when you're training or when you're just like lying in bed or something, that's a sure sign that my minerals need to bump up. Yeah, what else do I do? I do stretching, foam rolling. I do some sort, like I often do, you know, a Pilates or / yoga session if I want to train on that day, but I don't want to do a high intensity day because I feel sore or whatever. I find stretching is kind of a, you know, it's not recommended as much as it should be. And it really does help in so many different ways, because not only does it help your muscles recover, but it also is really big for helping you get into that parasympathetic state where you're just completely relaxed again. So I like using that. Something interesting about me, which I found, is that I am more, I guess you could say, more nervous system sensitive and not super bodily sensitive, if that makes sense. I don't know if that makes sense to you. It might be from my background as well of doing CrossFit, but my nervous system is sensitive in the sense that I can tell that my nervous system suffers if I'm under recovered. My body tends to be quite resilient. It kind of just bounces back really well. But my nervous system is where that's why the heart rate variability comes in really handy, because I can tell that, you know, if my nervous system is not recovered, I'll feel that inability to relax. I'll just feel like stress, almost anxiety, as opposed to my body, you know, telling me like, oh, you're super sore, or my temperature dropping or anything like that. So I think, like I said, you just got to be more aware of what works for you. So, you know, journaling really helps me. All these other sort of nervous system type things help me more than the physical things. But yeah, everyone's different.
Yeah, I would say I'm very similar in that aspect too. My body recovers very quickly, but my mind, on the other hand, yeah.
Yeah.
I can tell whenever I'm more on the anxious side, like my anxiety starts to get really crazy whenever I don't recover properly.
Yeah, it's crazy. Have you used heart rate variability at all? Have you like dug into that at all? Mm. I feel like for people like you or me, it's pretty good, because it really does, like, sometimes, you know, when you wake up and you're just like, you already feel that anxiousness when you just wake up. Mm-hmm. Those, if you look at your heart rate variability, it generally will show that it's like really lowered. So it's just such an interesting thing because it's different than heart rate. The heart rate variability is basically just the time in between the beats. So you don't want it to just be continuous and the same. You want it to be variable. So, you know, between one beat, it might be a certain amount of time. The next beat, it might be longer. The next beat. And the more variable it is, the more of a parasympathetic state you're in. So it's really interesting to, I found that really helped me with just, we don't need it. Like a lot of people are like, why do you need this to tell you that you're not recovered? And you don't, but it definitely helps me trust my body more. It makes me feel more safe in my body when I know that something's going on and then I can see that. And I'm like, you know what? I was right. Like I can feel that I'm not recovered and I have this data to tell me. So I like that. It's interesting as well about the nervous system. So I feel like sometimes if you're more nervous system sensitive, this is just a term I coined, that you need different things as well with recovery. Like I find that I like choline is really, really important in my diet. And that's obviously because your brain uses a lot of that as well. Whereas if you're like more sensitive to glycogen and you just bust through glycogen really fast, you'd want to make sure that you have a lot more glycogen in your muscles. Whereas for me, I eat like all feel really, really good when I eat eggs. It's like the food that just makes me feel the best. And they're really high in choline. So I think there's different things as well, like in the, if you are nervous system sensitive, that you can do in terms of diet to help you recover. And they might be a little bit different than someone who's just really, body sensitive, like, temperature drops and all that. I think those people are more need to go for the carbs and just bump those carbs up right away. Whereas for me, I find certain food choices really make a difference in terms of recovering the nervous system as well, which is interesting. Mm-hmm.
Is there a specific tool that you use to measure heart rate variability?
I have three different, I'm a bit of a, tracker type of person. So I use what's called the Whoop. Have you heard of it? It's WH. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there's also the Oura Ring, which I don't have, but I've heard really good things about that. And then I also have an Apple Watch. So, I don't wear the Apple Watch or the Whoop all the time, but I just kind of use them back and forth. The Whoop I'll wear at night. And that's what really tells me in the next morning, all these different like sleep data and that. But then the best way to actually track your heart rate variability and the most accurate, because the doing it at night when you're wearing something all night, you can actually get false results based on whether you're sleeping on your stomach or on your back or on your side. It can just change the results. So the best way to do it is to just get a heart rate strap. And then I don't remember the number, but there's one that's really just super easy and really good. And you just have a heart rate monitor and you just sit for 3 minutes every morning, try and do it at the same time, sit the same way, and then just check it. You can download an app and it just checks your heart rate variability and it gives you that same number. Cause then that way you don't have to wear it all the time as well. So that's what I've been getting most of my clients to do, is just to get the a heart rate strap and a monitor to go with it and just to measure it once every morning when they wake up.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Is there anything that you do to like buffer lactic acid whenever you're training?
That's where I would come back to that, just that movement and just, yeah, like for example, if I did a really hard training session, I'll just, go out and do some like a walk right after for 10 minutes or, some sort of movement, sled push and sled drag, get on the bike, just get your legs sort of going. For me, so when I was doing CrossFit, we had a term which we called like sled flu or prowler flu. It's basically when you get to that point where you're doing something like pushing a prowler, for example, and it's that extreme, like I'm talking over the top high intensity, and you just get that feeling. I don't know if you've ever had it, but that feeling in your legs where you literally, they're aching so much that you can't even walk and you can't even move. Have you ever had that? You get it from Airdyne as well. Like you jump on an Airdyne, those bikes, and you smash out as hard as you possibly can go. That's the same kind of, that's like the ultimate of lactic acid buildup basically. So when that was happening, I would just have to go outside and I just like walk it off. There's nothing else I could do. Cause if you sit down and you sit into it, then it's just going to get worse. So it's one of those things you just have to like, let it go away on its own. As far as flushing it out, I'd say probably jumping on a bike and just going slow is the best way to flesh it out, because, you know, if it's in your legs especially. I don't get that much now because I'm not really doing that type of training, but yeah, I would say that's probably the best way. That's the only way I can sort of get rid of it.
Mm-hmm. I would say,
what do you do?
Whenever I experienced that, it was back in high school. They would make us sprint around the track until we couldn't sprint any longer. And then like you would just slowly see people start to fall over. And then, yeah, it would take a while to recover from that. Mm-hmm. Back then I wasn't aware of the things that we should have been doing. So I didn't take my recovery as seriously as I should back then, but, yeah, I definitely know what you're talking about. And that is not fun at all.
No. And I would be smashing some, like if I had that happen to me now, I'd be smashing like the minerals right away, sodium, get all that in, just, you know, have a drink right there and just start drinking it. Some coconut water, salt, orange juice, you know, whatever you need to do to get, you want to basically replenish it and get yourself out of that state. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. I would say also titrating baking soda prior to like a big event is very beneficial in my experience.
That's a great idea, actually, yeah, because that does help buffer it too. So, yeah.
Ben Greenfield
actually
Ben Greenfield actually has some really good protocols for titrating sodium bicarbonate.
Yeah, I have looked at some of his work. He's awesome, yeah. I used to get it as well in my arms. Like, so if you do, so you know, like rope climbs in CrossFit, I would do like maybe 10 or 20 rope climbs. And it was often rope climbs or high rep pull-ups that would do it. And I would be so fucked, sorry if I'm swearing, that I would be driving home and I'd have to pull over and I'd be in tears from that. Have you ever had it in the biceps there, that feeling? It's just, oh my God. Like it made me scared of it. It made me scared of doing the aerodyne, scared of doing the sled sprints. But yeah, it's not fun, that lactic buildup.
No, not at all.
And it doesn't really do anything for the muscle growth. It's just, it's from a sports perspective. It's, yeah, that's when you see it the most.
Mm-hmm. Wait, so what benefit is there from doing something like that?
I would say the main benefit is honestly just that performance side of things. Like if you're needing to go to that place in competition, then you can push that threshold by training it. So you get, like, obviously the first time you do it, like I would have a new person come into CrossFit and put them on the aerodyne and they do like 1 minute and they have the lactic acid buildup, whereas the more you train it, the less it happens. So your body definitely becomes accustomed to it, and it gets, the threshold gets further and further away. So I would need to do like 10 sprints instead of 5. So from a competition perspective, like, we basically, it is survival of the fittest in every sense of the word when you're doing a CrossFit competition. And you also don't want to have that happen because that will inhibit your performance. So in that way, there's benefit. To be completely honest, I don't see much benefit in terms of your everyday person doing that style of training. It's just, it's putting a lot, again, it comes back to that, you know, stimulus versus fatigue, and that, you know, what's the point of doing, putting all that stress on your body? And I'm pretty logical in the sense that I always think, okay, so I'm putting this particular stress on my body. I want to get this result from it, because if I'm not getting this result, it's not worth it. And I feel like it's that with that type of training in for an everyday person, unless you have a reason to do it. I much prefer doing, you know, more of that sprinting where it's genuinely like 50 or 100 meters and you take that long rest, because I'm like all about the speed and power, which is, you know, it's obviously using a different energy system. It's using that top one, the creatine phosphate. So it's not really going to do that to you. Or going straight back all the way down and doing more of that recovery aerobic work. I do really like including that in my training, and then doing just the weightlifting and the bodybuilding and building muscle. Like, you know, anything that's going to help you build more muscle is definitely worth doing if it's going to be putting more muscle on your body. Like, that's pro-metabolic. So
speaking of building muscle, what exactly are the benefits to having more muscle mass from a hormonal perspective?
So in terms of hormonal, I would say just the metabolic benefits that it's going to be giving you. So you're going to be able to eat more food. You're going to be able to have a higher metabolic rate because you have more muscle. and, you know, more mitochondria. It's obviously anti-aging. So in terms of all of that, I would say that there's a huge benefit hormonally. In terms of like, you know, I think you can cross that line where you're going a little bit too extreme for some women, and they actually can end up, you know, hurting their hormones unless they're eating to fuel it and eating appropriately. And like I always say, I think I just did a podcast as well with like Kitty and Jess and a bunch of girls, and we were talking about how having that level of muscle is actually a responsibility, because your body, I guess, is a survival machine. So you know, it doesn't want to have muscle. It wants to have more body fat, because that's so much more, it's so much easier for it to fuel. And muscle is very metabolically expensive. So it's like, if you want to actually be able to walk around as a muscular human being, that's not supernatural. It's like more, you know, it's not really great for your body as far as when it comes to survival. So if you do want to, then that's a responsibility. But I feel like if you fuel it correctly and you look after yourself and you take your recovery seriously, then it can be extremely healthy. So it's like the, you know, the dose is the poison, and the dose is also like, I think it just comes back to, you know, making sure that you are doing it as healthy as possible, and it's a responsibility, and that you're fueling correctly, you're having enough protein and carbs. You know, you're taking your rest and your recovery seriously. Like, my sleep to me is like, you know, don't fuck with my sleep. It's like everything to me. So, and I'm willing to do all that because I want to have muscle and I want to be strong. And I want to, you know, when I get older and when I'm like in my 60s and 70s, I don't want to have like, you know, brittle bones and all this kind of stuff. So in that way, I'm absolutely for it. But I think oftentimes people can sort of do it the wrong way and they don't take it as a responsibility that it is. But yeah, hormonally, it's awesome. Like, 100%, especially also in terms of testosterone for women. I know we always talk about, like, you know, progesterone and estrogen, and, you know, being not having too much estrogen, having more progesterone. But I'm actually of the opinion that a lot of women don't have enough testosterone naturally. And, you know, just their body's ability to use that testosterone properly to, you know, build more muscle and that. And it's very much an anabolic hormone as well. It's anti-aging. It's awesome. Like, just like you would want to have progesterone as a woman, you also want to have enough testosterone. And that comes with weight training and building muscle. Like, you're just naturally going to have more of that. You're going to be, you know, feeling and looking younger for longer. So yeah, I would say it's definitely worth it.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious if you know the answer to this. In the concentric part of training, that's actually where the anabolic hormones are supposed to be produced. Do you know exactly how testosterone is produced in the concentric part of the movement?
No, I don't. Okay. I don't really know. Okay. I have heard a little bit about the concentric and the eccentric. And so obviously the eccentric phase is a lot more catabolic, or it basically is more stressful on the body. And the concentric phase is less stressful than that. But the issue I have with the people, the crowd that's always claiming, oh, we only need to do the concentric phase, is that the eccentric phase is also a huge component of mechanical tension. So that's actually where the muscle, that's like a huge part of it. And controlling the eccentric plays a huge role in mechanical tension. So I'd be asking, if you're only ever doing the concentric, are you actually as jacked as you could be? You know, like, you're probably not, because the eccentric phase is what really helps with that as well, especially the mechanical tension side of things. So yeah, I'm not against eccentric work at all. And I'm not going to just deadlift and dump the bar from the top every time or anything like that. I think, again, like, I feel like people need to allow the stress to happen sometimes. And this is where I feel like a lot of people are just so scared of every bit of stress. And, you know, it's fine. Like, I'd ask them, are you where you want? Do you have the results you want? Do you look the way you want? Do you feel the way you want? And if you do, then that's great. Maybe, you know, maybe you're onto something. But I also know that in order to get any result, it's basically the formula of stress plus recovery and rest equals result in any area of life, like in business, in, you know, in any area. So yeah, it's that balance, I think. But yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I went on a tangent there. Mm-hmm. What is, do you know the answer?
No, I wish I knew the answer. It's something that I've actually been curious about for a while now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because the hormones, I wonder if there is like a, I'd be really curious actually if there is a part of training that stimulates certain hormones over others. Yeah, like I know that estrogen in women is quite anabolic, so in that first half of our cycle in the follicular phase where we are more estrogen, we have more estrogen, it's actually a good time to focus on more of that, you know, those higher reps, that working closer to failure, you know, doing a lot more bodybuilding type stuff there, because you can actually use it to your advantage a little bit. And then the progesterone in that second phase where it's like your luteal phase, is you tend to actually burn more fat in that phase because progesterone burns more fat naturally. So I would say then if you wanted to do, you know, more of like those, you know, aerobic type activities, if you were going to divide up your month of training, which I don't personally, I just do the same thing all month, but yeah, then you would probably put that there more.
Interesting. Fascinating. Is there a certain macronutrient balance that you find works best?
For me or just in general?
I'd say both.
Yeah. I always like to see around 50% carbs minimum. And then protein generally around like, you know, 25 to 30%, I would say. Yeah.
And then you just,
and then you just fill in the fat. Yeah. I wouldn't like to ever see someone get lower than in fat than 0.8 times their body weight in kilos of grams per day. That's kind of my limit as far as I feel like if you go much lower than that, you can be doing damage in terms of, you know, how much like, you know, fat affects our hormones and that. So I wouldn't like to go lower than that. It's really interesting because I did like my HTMA and that full Monty panel with, because Jessica Ash was going to like talk to my members and we did it as like a thing just out of interest. And so she went over my results with them and that. And in there, it shows that I'm a fast oxidizer. So I think that's like you're either a slow oxidizer or a fast oxidizer. And it's the way that you use energy and whether you do better with more fats or more carbs. And I'm a fast oxidizer and, you know, I burn through minerals super fast. Like my minerals, I just go through them. And apparently you're supposed to use more fats if you're that. So I've actually been playing. I bumped my fats up because I was always eating around 65 grams of fat a day and I bumped them up to 80 grams just the past like 3 weeks. And it's felt good. Like I've took my carbs down a touch just to balance it out a bit. Keep like granted I eat quite a lot, so it's not like my carbs went down like to any bad amount or whatever, but I feel good still. Like in training it hasn't affected me at all. So yeah, I think, you know, you can kind of be flexible with the carbs and fats, as long as I would say the main thing would be the blood sugar balancing, always making sure that you're having more carbs than protein in each meal. But one thing that I do, I'm pretty big on, which probably not all the pro-metabolic people are, is protein. I would say I'm more of a higher protein kind of coach in so, terms of, yeah, because I guess the women I work with are all building muscle, so they need it too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So would you say like around like 1 gram per pound?
Yeah, that's a good guide. Oftentimes I'll say per, like with the protein, I'll say like 2.2 to 2.4 per kilo of lean mass versus complete body mass. But it just depends. Like it's hard to say because some people are obviously weigh more, so they might not need that much protein. But I really do think protein, the reason to have enough protein is to support the lean mass as well in terms of bodybuilding. So if you are someone who has a high body fat percentage, you wouldn't necessarily need to go 1 gram per pound. You could go more a gram per pound of lean mass, if that makes sense, just so you don't have to take too much from your carbs then, you know. But yeah, definitely that's such a good general guide, 1 gram per pound. Yeah. I mean, I'll have about 150, 160 grams of protein a day. So it's pretty high. Like, I mean, people would probably be like, that's a lot, but you know, I really love it as well. So I think it just depends what you enjoy eating and that too.
Absolutely. Are there certain carb sources that you found work better for you?
Yeah. So again, like probably not super, it's not super pro-metabolic in terms of the way I eat necessarily, but I do like starches personally. fruit just doesn't do it for me. That's all I ate. Like literally, it just, I'm hungry within an hour if I eat fruit. It's like, I need some substance. I'm like a substance girl. So I love, you know, I'm not someone who can't handle any food. So I can even eat gluten. Like I'm fine with it personally, but I think a lot of people would need to be careful with that in terms of digestion. My favorite, all-time favorite is white rice. But I grew up in Thailand. So I was born there and I grew up there and I was there until I was 18. So rice was literally breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Like it's staple, as you would know, just white jasmine rice. So that's like, that makes me feel amazing. I generally go by how I feel and how food makes me feel. Rice makes me feel amazing. It keeps me full. I don't have any digestive issues. I love oats, sourdough. Those are probably my favorite starchy sources. And then of course I love, you know, potatoes, root vegetables, lots of fruit, lots of juice, all that stuff. It's great as well. And I do like how combining a starchy carb with some form of fructose, so source of fruit as well. Not so much in terms of, you know, digestion, but more so in terms of, because when you are training or if you've just trained, you're then replenishing the liver glycogen and also the muscle glycogen, because the fruit needs to go to the livers first, the liver first to turn into glycogen, and then it turns into muscle glycogen after. So it's kind of like your backup storage, whereas starchy carbs go straight into muscle glycogen. So I just like covering all the bases there with that.
So is there typically like a certain amount of fructose to other kind of carbohydrates whenever you're like putting them together?
I don't really care too much about that in terms of like amounts. Like a really common pre-workout thing I'll have is like oats, which I have like overnight oats, and then I'll add like bananas and berries to that. So it's obviously more starch to fruit. But then if I'm going to flip it around and I'm going to have it for dinner after I've trained and I've had my post-workout and that, then I'll probably have, you know, a little bit of root vegetables and some potatoes, and then I'll have like more fruit. So yeah, it just depends. I do like having a lot of fruit before, like in my last meal before bed, I like having that to be higher fruit. And then in my morning meal, my first meal of the day, I also like to have more fruit there. And I have more fat as well in that meal, because I find that it makes me feel really good to start the day with that. So yeah, like I would say, so if I usually try to train in the middle of the day, so I'll have most of my starchy carbs before training and most of my starchy carbs in the meal after training. Just not because I have any issues with digestion, but just because I'm like all about, you know, how much muscle I can build, and I want to be like doing everything I can, all those like, you know, small little things to help.
Absolutely. Is there a certain amount of protein that you do pre and post workout?
Yeah. So in general with protein, I like to also divide it pretty evenly across the board as far as having it in each meal. So I tend to eat like, you know, 4 or 5 meals a day, and I'll put the, you know, same amount in each meal just to help make sure that I'm hitting that amount to stimulate muscle protein synthesis all throughout the day, as opposed to like, I think the big mistake a lot of women make as well is that they have just like 10 grams for this meal and then 10 grams for their snack and then, you know, another like maybe 15 grams and then they'll have like 40 grams at dinner. But then they're missing that opportunity if they are someone who trains to have their muscle protein synthesis switched on, because you need to have at least, I think it's 22 grams of protein, of good quality protein, to actually stimulate muscle protein synthesis. And you want to be able to do that at least every 3 hours to keep it on the whole day. And that really helps, particularly with building muscle. So I tend to just do that across the board, and I have like a minimum of like 30 grams in my pre-workout and my post-workout meals. I think something I've read in a study was that if you're going to have, you know, if you're going to do that, it's good to have, say, a minimum 22 grams in every meal. But then if you want to really nail it, you can bump it up to 40 grams in your post-workout meal and up to 40 grams in your snack before bed. Because that's also, you know, with a slow digesting one like casein or cottage cheese, because that's going to help keep your muscle protein synthesis switched on through the night as well. But that's just kind of like when we're getting into like the nitty gritty of it. So I think as a guide, just try as much as possible to divide it up equally throughout your day, mm-hmm. the protein. That's a good, easy thing to think of.
Definitely. So You typically eat every 3 hours throughout the day?
Yeah, generally three to four. Yeah.
Okay. What about supplementation? Is there any specific supplements that you'll use?
So I take creatine. I don't take it all year. I'll take it for like 6 months of the year. Generally when I'm doing more muscle building phases, like really, you know, when I'm into that surplus as well. So I like, I'll go into a little bit of a surplus. I'll take creatine and that, cause I find it just helps. It really does help. Like I feel the difference in training, in lifting. I feel like I can just keep lifting those heavier weights for longer. So it's interesting that I noticed that. A lot of people don't notice anything from it. I sometimes take taurine as well. I take it in. So I have like an intra workout drink I'll drink where it'll have basically coconut water, orange juice, salt, and then I'll add my own cyclic dextrin. Have you ever heard of that?
Is it similar to like dextrose?
It's similar, but it's a little bit different in that it digests really fast. So your body just absorbs it really fast. So I'll often have that sometimes. And then I'll put like just plain whey protein, just a little bit, like just completely unflavored, good quality whey protein, and then creatine and taurine. Shake it up and sip on it throughout my session. So, you know, it's just one of those drinks that I like. It makes me feel good as well. That's probably pretty much all. I don't take much supplements in terms of like protein powders often. I like whey protein better than casein, just in terms of how I like it, you know. But I just get really good quality whey protein, pure, no additives, and I just I don't have it like every day either. What else do I have? I'm actually taking cod liver oil at the moment. Just like the Rosita's one. So because I eat liver a lot, but when I did my blood tests and that, my vitamin A was still pretty low. And I don't know if you've heard about like the full Monty blood tests, but it shows like your stored iron and copper and magnesium and everything, and my ceruloplasmin, which is like what puts the copper around your body, was on the lower end as well, and the vitamin A was on the lower end, and they work together. So it starts with like the vitamin A, so you need the vitamin A to actually, you know, produce more copper. And so because it was kind of trending low, and I eat liver every day pretty much, Jessica Ash was like, why don't you just try it for a little bit? And it's interesting because cod liver oil is not like fish oil in that it's actually monounsaturated. So it's basically all monounsaturated fats. And there's barely any PUFAs in it. So it's really, really low. And like, if you put it in the fridge, it thickens. So it's like an olive oil basically. So, cause I was a little bit like, oh, fish oil, you know, and I know like, you know, people are really against that as well, but it's not really fish oil. It's like the liver of the fish. So yeah, I've been taking that. I was telling Jess, I was like, I wake up and my skin is glowing the next day, because I'll take like a tablespoon of it. And it's so, yeah, I don't know. That's something I've been trying, which is probably not pro-metabolic, but
yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. I've heard mixed stories on the cod liver oil. I really don't have an opinion. I think, you know, if you try and it works for you, then do it.
Yeah. Well, I was going to do it for 6 months and then retake my blood test and see if it actually increased my vitamin A. It's interesting because my vitamin A, you would think it would be pretty high. Like not many people eat liver, and I don't take liver tablets. I actually eat pate every day, pretty much like 5 days a week, but it was still pretty low. Hmm. So it goes to show that, you know.
Is the pate pretty cooked? Is it pretty well cooked?
So I used to do that, but I don't do it anymore. So I used to do it in a slow cooker. And then I was like thinking about it, and I was like, I'm kind of overcooking it because it's like a few hours. So now I literally just like super quickly on the fry pan. So it's still got that red, you know, that pink tint when you, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is that a thing?
I was going to say if you overcook it, typically it's going to denature some of the vitamin A. Yeah. So you don't really get it.
That's so interesting, because I was doing that until like probably the last couple months.
Interesting.
Yeah,
that could definitely be it.
And I found as well, when I was taking the vitamin A capsules, I started getting cracks on the side of my mouth. So I went through like a phase of just taking the capsules and not eating the liver, and I started getting cracks on the side of my mouth. And again, something that I was looking into is B vitamins. And because I think, because also I burn through vitamins and minerals pretty fast, I think that when you, maybe that it takes out the B vitamins or it makes them less effective from, because you know how they're so rich in liver as well. Mm-hmm. And that's a symptom of not getting enough B vitamins. So I went straight back to like the real liver and no problems.
Interesting. Is it pretty good to, is it pretty easy to get good liver where you're at?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. We're super lucky here because the butchers and the meats and the dairy, you can get really high quality. You can't get raw dairy, which is kind of annoying, but you can get like really high quality and they don't put any, you know, added vitamin D or anything like that in it. So it's nice. Vitamin A, they don't add anything. The meats, you can get like, I get it from regenerative farms, which is pretty much all our meat. I try as best as possible. Like I know it's more expensive and it's hard for people to do, but I just feel like, you know, at least I'm doing my part with that and supporting like, you know, the those farmers that are doing the right thing. So I do get it from there and I know where it's coming from. And yeah, it's awesome to be able to have that here.
Definitely. Well, Libby, I really appreciate you hopping on today. I've really enjoyed our conversation. Where can people find you as far as social media, website, all that good stuff?
Yeah, so you can just find me on my Instagram. It's Libby Westcombe. So it's pretty easy to find. My website is called eatersize.com.au. I don't update that often. I probably should, but I'm pretty active on my Instagram. And then my email is on my Instagram as well. So you can just shoot me an email if you, you know, need anything.
Sounds good. Well, thanks again. And I look forward to being able to chat again in the future.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you haven't already, make sure to hit the like button, subscribe, and leave a comment down below if you want us to cover a different topic.